provoking conflict, trouble, right? That's what it means in verse 50, that they raised up persecution against Paul. They were so invigorated at this that they just stirred the pot and created all this trouble. So the first raised up is Paul standing up. The last raised up is them creating trouble. And all the ones in the middle are this interesting phrase about raising up. Yes, sometimes for the purpose of not physical resurrection, but clearly tied within it is the picture of the Lord rising from the dead. The fifth point then was this whole idea of being raised up. And the sixth point that I'd like to bring up, and Matt may add some to these when he gets going with it, is the theme throughout all of this that he is presenting to them is that it is all of God's doing. The deliverances, the provision, the protection, the guiding, all of this is done by God. There is nothing that man has done to contribute to what God has provided here. And this is part of the backdrop then of what he is saying to these people in the synagogue there in Antioch. And one of the other things I think about is that if you were sitting listening to this retelling of the history, and mind you, most of these people should have known a lot of the details of this history. You know, how they complained in the wilderness, they rebelled here, they rebelled there, they did all of these things. And as he's recounting this, the only phrase that we have that hints at that is in verse 18, now for the time about 40 years, he put up with their ways in the wilderness. You know, you can see kind of tolerating it, you know, with the, you know, you're on the edge of the seat ready to discipline. But Bill McDonald says the word is usually used in a positive sense that, you know, he took care of them, almost like the Psalm 23, the shepherd caring for them. But what really strikes me is that in all of these situations, you see all of their rebellions, and yet God in his grace and mercy continuing to provide for them. So what I wonder is, are they supposed to also realize that instead of getting mercy and grace from God, they should have gotten judgment? And it just reminds me of some other verses like Psalm 36. Your mercy, O Lord, in the heavens, your faithfulness in the clouds, your righteousness is like the great mountains, your judgments are like the great deep, and so forth like that. But with whatever time I have left, which I don't have a whole lot, I just want to try to see then if we can see a little bit more of this thought flow. So he reminds them in verse 19 that when he had destroyed seven nations of the land of Canaan, he distributed the land to them by allotment. God did it. God broke it up and gave them their land. Then it says he gave them judges for about 450 years until Samuel the prophet. So remember in the book of Judges, these men were judges, but we think of judges as sitting behind the bench and, you know, saying guilty or not guilty. But it much bigger picture than that. They were deliverers. They were literally saviors. And these were men who God had selected to help the people. For example, Gideon, right? He led them in that tremendous victory over their enemies. So these men were not just judges, but they were deliverers. They were saviors. And so he's reminding them that God had provided saviors or deliverers for them along the way. And then another one of their faux pas, you might say, was in verse 21, they asked for a king, right? Why did they ask for a king? Because everybody else had a king that guided them, and we don't like not being able to see your face, God. Give us somebody we can look at. And God gave them what they asked for, which is a lesson right there, right? Sometimes God gives us the things we ask for, even though he doesn't want us to have it, and all they do is plague us for a time afterwards. But he gave them their king, and he made a mess of things, right? And please notice verse 22, when he had removed him. Isn't that interesting? How did Saul die? Did God strike him with a lightning bolt? No. God allowed the enemy to defeat them, and then Saul killed himself. And yet it says that God removed him. And we forget that God doesn't have to physically lay his hand on somebody to accomplish his end. He works in unusual ways, right? And so he removed him. And then in verse 22, where he says, he raised up for him David as a king, received a testimony, I have found David, the son of Jesse, a man after my own heart. And so we have that reminder that in 1 Samuel 13, that he says, but now your kingdom shall not continue, for the Lord has sought for himself a man after his own heart, and the Lord has commanded him over his people. So we have that reminder that God looked at David as this man after his own heart. And then from there, we read that from this man's seed, according to the promise, God raised up for Israel a Savior, Jesus. From this man's seed, a descendant of David would be the one that he would go. So he goes right from David to Jesus. One of the interesting questions, I think, that comes out of this is, What do we do with according to the promise? Is that the promise given in Samuel, 2 Samuel, about somebody from the line of David would sit on the throne forever? I think yes. But I also think it goes back to Abraham and the promise that God had made to Abraham of what God was going to do for him. And so to me, it was quite interesting in our worship time to be reminded that not one word of what God has said would ever not be fulfilled. He's always faithful to his word. And so he brings into this the subject then this Savior, Jesus. But then notice, he drops Jesus, and now he backtracks a little bit, and he says, remember this guy, John the Baptist? He came along to tell you that this Messiah was coming, and he's much greater than I am. But when he had finished doing what he was supposed to do, as it says, he says, you know, I'm not worthy to undo his sandal strap. And then he goes and he looks right at him and he says, men and brethren, sons of the family of Abraham, to those among you who fear God, to you the word of this salvation has been sent. To those among you who fear God, do you recognize that God is still over all? And he's speaking to their hearts. And it's a tremendous change in direction. This is what God has done. He raised up Jesus. John the Baptist announced him. The nation rejected him, but he is the one that you should be looking for. And then he reminds them that in verse 27, that those who dwelt in Jerusalem, because of their blindness, you might say, because they did not know him, they didn't pay attention to the voice of the prophets, and get this little phrase, they read every day, every Sabbath day. It was right in front of their noses, but they couldn't understand it. And I wonder if that was a little bit of a challenge to the audience he's speaking to. And then, but then it says that they fulfilled them by condemning him. This is an amazing statement. The purpose and plan of God was fulfilled by the rebellious Jews killing the Messiah and having him be sacrificed on the tree. And so when it says then, though they found no cause of death in him, they asked Pilate that he should be put to death. That's a pretty sad statement, isn't it? No reason to kill him, but kill him anyway. And then finally, as he finishes it off, he says, when they have fulfilled all that was written concerning him, they took him down from the tree and laid him in a tomb. When they had fulfilled all that was. And so he's talking about all those Old Testament prophecies that talked about the suffering Messiah, the Isaiah 53s and the things like that. And so what was this triggering in the thinking of the people? Were they thinking of verses that they knew, like they shall look on him whom they have pierced? Or the one about the stone which the builders rejected has become the chief corners. What kind of things would it provoke in their thinking? Because they would know many of these scriptures. They didn't understand them, and sometimes they didn't want to understand them. but he's appealing to their